This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
It's the February episode. Welcome, listeners. I'm Chris Bramley, the magazine's editor, and I'm joined in the studio today by staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
And news editor Elizabeth Pearson.
Hello.
Special thanks to Ezzy coming in. You've got the slight sniffles today, so thank you very much for making the effort, Ezzy.
Sure, Ez.
Coming up later in this episode, we'll be talking to Martin Harwit from Cornell University about how some of the most familiar objects in the night sky were discovered. And we'll give you our top stargazing tip of this month. But now, we're going to be taking a look at what we found out while putting together the February edition of the magazine.
Yes.
Ian, what stood out from you for the February issue?
Well, we've been discussing, I mean, the year kind of started off with a bit of a big bang, really, metaphorically speaking, of course, just in terms of space exploration. It's already got off to a good start because, of course, we had the New Horizons Ultima Thule flyby on New Year's Day, and then the Chang'e 4 Chinese lunar explorer landed on the dark side. Well, sorry, I shouldn't say the dark side, the far side of the moon on the 3rd of January. The flyby of Ultima Thule is pretty. I mean, it's the farthest kind of cosmic encounter humans have ever achieved. And in case anyone's kind of late to the story, so Ultima Thule is like a Kuiper Belt object on the edge of the solar system.
Beyond Pluto.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And these objects are probably about 4.5 billion years old, probably left over from the formation of the solar system. So obviously studying them means that you kind of get a look at what the early solar system might have been like, how the solar system might have formed, and as a result, potentially how other planetary systems around stars have formed. I mean, we got like an initial data, and there's nothing really kind of mind-blowing that's come in yet. I mean, we know that Ultima Thule, the Kuiper Belt object, is red in colour. It's like two lobes, and people were comparing it to like a chicken drumstick or like a snowman online.
or BB-8, Star Wars toy.
I like those, because the snowman, because the pictures always make it look sort of like this lovely grey colour, but actually it's sort of this dark
it's rusty,
red.
Isn't it?
I think it's supposed to be about as bright as potting soil.
That's weird.
So it's a dirty chicken drumstick.
or a bowling pin, I find, which I suppose maybe. It's like 30 kilometers in diameter, just to give you an idea. And it seems to be kind of what we've found so far is what isn't there. So we know that there's no evidence of rings or moons around the object. There's no evidence of an atmosphere. And apparently it's going to take like 20 months to receive all the data from the flyby.
I mean, it's so far away, isn't it? The downlink time is huge, isn't it?
I remember reading somewhere that its download speed is 20 times slower than a dial-up modem.
Whoa.
Oh, that's crazy.
And I remember trying to download pictures on a dial-up modem, and that took long enough, let alone trying to do it from the other end of the solar system.
The edge of the solar system, yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I can't remember the stat exactly, but it was something like the mission was effectively like driving past a house that's 2 miles away at 300 miles per hour and trying to take a photo of it.
Yeah.
It was, because it's moving at colossal speed, isn't it? 20 miles a second or something.
It was until Parker launched. I'm pretty sure New Horizons was the fastest man-made object.
And of course, it's kind of since 2015, it was spent all its time around the Pluto system, looking at Pluto. And then it was kind of one of those classic NASA, like, well, we've got this spacecraft. It doesn't have any fuels, but we can probably use gravitational pull to fling it out towards the Kuiper Belt and see what happens.
Still work.
I think it's got enough thrusters to be able to just kind of like flick it like a couple of degrees one way or another.
Yeah, exactly.
To sort of fine tune it. I think they're also looking for, or they will be soon, looking for a third target that they might be able to fly
past.
That's
pretty handy, isn't it? Being able to zip between these two, all these kind of distant objects.
Exactly. And you kind of wonder, like, the success of this, does this kind of raise the potential for, you know, a future expedition to go out and look at, like, one of the dwarf planets in the Kuiper Belt, maybe, like, you know, Eris or something like that. But speaking of which, if you do manage to get a copy of our February issue this month in the bonus content, I was speaking to Kerry Lissa, who's one of the New Horizons team, and he's kind of giving us the lowdown and all the info so far and what to expect in the coming months. Apparently, we're going to get a lot better images and science results around March time, so that'll be worth looking out for.
Awesome.
And as we said, the Chinese Space Agency has put a lunar lander and a rover on the far side of the moon.
This is really exciting, isn't it? Yeah. Historic first landing on the far side, isn't it? Because up until now, up until that mission, the only people to have seen the far side of the moon were the Apollo astronauts in the command module.
Yeah.
The loneliest people in
Michael
history.
Collins, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was some orbiters that went round to take pictures, so the moon's been fully mapped. But yes, there's... They knew people to see it with their own eyes.
And they know that it's a lot more cratered and crusty. I mean, I guess that's because the moon's tidally locked, so it's more exposed to...
It's one of the big questions is that the moon is slightly lopsided. Its crust is thicker on one side than it is on the other. There's more mare on our side of the moon, so the big, you know, the man in the moon craters like the Sea of Tranquility and stuff, than there is on the far side. And no one's 100% sure why. There's a lot of different theories about it to do with the tidal locking. But that's one of those things that is still being researched and hoping to find out soon.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there was quite a lot of stuff on social media and different people weighing in because the images that have come back show the lunar surface as being red, and that's to do with it being like raw data because, as we know from like the Cassini and the Juno missions, and the red and the green and the blue channels are all done separately and then they're all put together. You can see raw images of Juno, or sorry, Jupiter, if you go on the Juno website, and you can kind of download those, and if you know what you're doing, put the images together and do a bit of imaging yourself. But David Rothery from the Planetary Society was kind of, he's got a good article about it on the Planetary Society website. ESA's Mark McCochrane was on Twitter and he had done his own image calibration and shown how if you treat the channels properly and expand the green and the blue, it does end up being grey, like the surface of the moon, like the Apollo.
Well, some people saying that it was this conspiracy theory. They just did it in a hangar.
Yeah.
In Shaanxi or something like that.
The thing that amused me most was, because obviously it happened, you know, a couple of days after the Ultima Thule flyby, and you're seeing these Ultima Thule pictures where it was grey even though it was red, and you were seeing the moon where it was red even though it was grey, and it was like they've got the things the wrong way around. But I have loved seeing sort of more information coming out of the Chang'e 4 lander. Like this morning they announced that they'd managed to actually there's some bean sprouts. Onboard experiment to see if you can like create to grow things on the moon and create a sort of like closed environment, and they got their first bean sprout. This
and
morning.
It sprouted. Wow.
Yes.
Because it's incredible because they've got like seeds and insect eggs. So the hope is that obviously the insects will produce carbon dioxide.
And then the plants
will photosynthesize they'll create their own wee atmosphere. And they only, it's supposed to be like kind of like Earth-like conditions apart from gravity, from like the lower gravity. So then they'll have a similar control on Earth and see, you know, I suppose.
That's fascinating. The kind of the cheapest and most effective quick way of creating a kind of biome.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I suppose with a view to, in theory at least, working out whether or not you could do similar things with humans and larger vegetation.
That is definitely the sort of, well, same with NASA, is their long-term goal is to get humans out into space, potentially colonizing or setting up some kind of permanent base on the moon and getting onto Mars. That's always been their long-term goal. They're going about it methodically.
Yeah.
So who knows? Maybe one day.
Yeah.
Definitely something to keep an eye on in the months to come, I think.
Definitely,
this year.
Yeah. Thanks, Ian. Thanks. I spotted something that was also in our news pages this month. A smaller story caught my eye, which is about black holes. Now, they're some of the brightest and hottest objects in the universe. But some research into supermassive black holes recently has found that come up with something decidedly unsuperlative.
Nice.
Now, black holes have a kind of corona around them, which is like superheated gas, kind of like the sun. But in the case of supermassive black holes, these are superheated phenomenally, and they're a billion degrees centigrade. And it's long been assumed that these coronae were heated by the magnetic field, the energy in the magnetic field around the black hole. And a team of Japanese scientists from RIKEN and the Japanese space agency JAXA did some measurements of the magnetic field around two kind of nearby black holes in the universe, and they found that the magnetic fields were less strong than a fridge magnet. That's incredible. I just kind of went ah like that when I read the thing, because I was just so astounded. You know, you see all these black holes, they kind of build as these kind of colossal violent behemoths that would suck you in and turn you into spaghetti if ever you got close to the event horizon. And actually, we're talking about energies on the scale of a fridge magnet. I find that just amazing, you know.
But this isn't like the same as their gravitational pull, because obviously their gravitational pull has to be stronger than the speed of light.
They are still black holes are points in space where everything's become so dense that not even their gravitational pull is such that even light can't escape.
Yes.
That is still the same. They are still incredibly dense. The gravitational pull is ridiculous once you get past the event horizon. But yeah, it's apparently they don't have much of a magnetic field, which kind of makes sense to me, because if you think about it, in the sun and the earth and the planets that we know about, the magnetic field is caused by stuff moving around. And admittedly, I don't know what goes on inside of a black hole. I don't think anybody does, but I can't really imagine it. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff moving around in there. Yeah. So, yeah.
But it's funny, it's interesting. So I'd always kind of thought, you know, with these colossal gravitational attraction of the mass of a black hole, you know, the kind of most massive things in the universe, you know, the whole everything around about it would be of that order of magnitude.
Yeah.
You know, the temperature is of a billion degrees. Some of the hottest things in the whole cosmos. And yet, you know, we just don't know now what's driving the thing, because, you know, astronomers had all assumed that there was this colossal magnetic field around.
Exactly.
They measured two of them, and they both turned out to be rather weak, which is a really interesting development in the latest in the fascinating story of black holes, which leads us nicely onto our interview.
It does indeed, actually. Yeah. This episode, I'm talking to Martin Harwit, who's an astronomer from Cornell University, and he's talking about his new book, Cosmic Discovery. Well, I say new. It's actually being re-released after over 35 years. And the book is really about how the familiar objects in the night sky were first discovered. And I started off by asking Martin, what have been the biggest discoveries since his book was first released?
There are two major discoveries that have been made since that time. The first one is that we are able to observe neutrinos coming in from the universe. The second one is that we can observe gravitational waves coming in from the universe. The first one is important because we can obtain signals from supernovae, which tell us what is going on in the center of a supernova just at the time that it's exploding. The second one is important because it tells us that the theory of general relativity of Einstein is correct, and that there are major investments the universe makes in emitting signals as gravitational waves, and that was something that we did not know before.
Mm-hmm. And the book obviously is all about cosmic discovery, you know, hence the title. But it's being re-released now after, I think, it's a period of over 35 years. First of all, why did you decide to write the book in the first place? And second of all, why did you decide to re-release it?
I wrote it in the first place for two reasons. One of them was that astronomers were making detailed plans every 10 years for what equipment should be built, what major telescopes ought to be constructed and installed. But the major discoveries that we were making were coming in from quite a different area, a different region. They were being made by smaller instruments, radio instruments, X-ray detectors, infrared detectors. All were hand-me-downs from the military. And so there was a disconnect between where the discoveries were coming from and what the major committees that the astronomical community had set up was advising NASA and the National Science Foundation. And I wanted to show that contrast and show that we needed to do things differently in some way and what that difference might be. The second point about writing Cosmic Discovery was that there seemed to be ways of gauging how much more was to be done in astronomy, what the limitations would be about what we were able to find out, and among the many phenomena that had been discovered, how many more of the same magnitude could we expect in the future? And those were the two major topics that I tried to portray. The second thrust was in response to a sort of hand-waving argument that people always had, well, we don't know, there'll be an infinite number of things we could discover in the universe. We'll never run out of things to discover. And I felt that that was inaccurate description of what the universe was like.
Could you foresee a period in that kind of hypothetical future when humanity has discovered everything there is to know about the universe? Do you think that that would be possible?
The answer is sort of twofold again. One is what you mean by we have discovered everything. It looks to me now that as though there are certain things that the universe very efficiently hides from us. It just erases information very assiduously. And so there are things that we won't find out because the universe decided not to let us see that part of its history. The other thing is that we are going to reach a limit at which we have constructed all the instruments, most likely, that are going to be useful for studying the universe, because it only has a certain number of media through which it can transmit information. And I think that we will be reaching at some point, maybe within the next couple of centuries, where we have built all the instruments that would allow us access to what the universe is allowing us to see. Then after that, we can keep looking, and sometimes maybe we'll find something that has come through that we had missed before. But it won't be for want of having the instruments available. It'll just be that some things the universe only very seldom sends out signals in, and we will then find those signals, but they're probably not going to be very influential in letting us understand what the universe does.
Just to come back to your first point there, I'm wondering if you could give me or give us an example or two of some of the things that the universe is particularly good at hiding from us.
Well, certainly the universe is very efficiently hiding from us what was going on in the first several hundred thousand years of its existence. At that time, there was just this fog of free electrons that were floating around. Atoms hadn't formed because the universe was too hot, so electrons were dissociated from atomic nuclei, mainly protons, and a fog of electrons scatters light extremely efficiently at all wavelengths. And so no electromagnetic or light signals, radio waves, and so forth could come out of this fog. And so we are unable to look back using light or using X-rays or using infrared or radio emission to see anything. You know, it's as though you're just enveloped and everything has been enveloped in this fog and we won't see anything. Now, if there were neutrinos emitted at that time, as we suspect there were, then we might be able to see something, but even those would probably be just uniformly spread around the whole universe, and we would just see an neutrino background radiation uniformly spread across the sky. And that's actually something that we're looking for now.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what you were saying there about kind of reaching the limit of the different instruments that we can build, because I think there's quite a complicated relationship between the progress of technology and astronomy and cosmology and what we want to discover. I would be interested to hear what you think is the kind of relationship between technology and astronomical discovery. Do you think one fuels the other? Does discovery fuel technology, or technology fuel discovery, or is it a bit of both?
Technology produces discoveries. There's no question. After World War II, we were being handed antiquated instruments that the military had used the previous year, but now they were no longer tip of the technology, and so we would get radio techniques that hadn't been available until about a year ago, and we could use those. They were handed down because now the military had that much better, 2 times, 3 times, 5 times, 10 times better radio techniques available to itself. And so it figured they might as well hand down to the astronomers those things that were useful a year or two ago, but no longer were at the forefront of technology. And as a result, in the 1950s and 60s, we were steadily discovering pulsars and quasars and magnetic fields in interstellar space, all through the radio techniques that had been made available to us, essentially free of charge in the United States by the military. Same thing with infrared detectors. All of infrared astronomy, where we now see thermal emission coming from all over the universe in different forms, those detectors all were made available by the military because they were looking for thermal radiation from all kinds of military targets that otherwise would be invisible. And to top this all off, the first real gamma ray bursts that were observed by a technique that the military had developed of placing military satellites in space so that they would be able to see whether the Soviet Union was conducting secret nuclear bomb bursts out in space, which would have violated the nuclear armament disarmament treaties that had been negotiated in the early 1960s. And so the military actually kept the discovery of gamma ray bursts from the universe secret for about 3 years until they decided, well, they could now afford to make them public, and published it in the Astrophysical Journal Letters, much to the surprise of astronomers who had never expected them. So you can see it was really pervasive. Technology brought about the discoveries, and still do.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting there that you're saying that a lot of the astronomical equipment that made the big discoveries were kind of essentially hand-me-downs from the military. Do you think that the cosmic discovery would be a lot greater if all that knowledge and money had been spent on science and astronomy in the first place?
No, I don't think so, because scientists tend to be very conservative. And so once they have some tools in hand, they keep on replicating those tools, making them a little more sensitive. They don't think about other tools that were outside the immediate domain. And this is something that at least was certainly true of pre-World War II astronomers who kept building better and better optical telescopes. And even until the end of the 1960s, the national plans that astronomers were proposing were plans for building bigger telescopes of the same kind that they'd used before. They weren't thinking of building telescopes sensitive to X-rays or gamma rays, or looking for neutrinos, or looking for gravitational waves. Those influences came in from the physics community that thought that there might be something that could be done in those with that kind of messengers, namely neutrinos and gravitational waves, that would allow them to understand their own theories better, general relativity and nuclear physics theories. And so that was the driving force, that it came from the physics community rather than from the astronomy community. And that's what the book was trying to point out, and eventually became actually the basis on which NASA then decided to build the Great Observatories. This group of four observatories, one dedicated to gamma rays, one to X-rays, one to the infrared, and the Hubble Space Telescope put out in space for visible work. But it was only the visible component of that was only one quarter, and the other three were for X-rays, gamma rays, and the infrared, which until fairly recently at that time, astronomers had only young astronomers were using those. The establishment astronomers were still just asking for optical sensors.
One of the other things that you discuss in the book is the idea that so many of the big discoveries were made effectively by accident, by people who weren't looking for what they essentially found. I think it's very interesting to consider that. Do you think that kind of serendipity has played just as an important part in our knowledge of the universe?
I think it's not quite as prevalent now, but it's certainly true that almost every time that we install a new capability, such as, for example, the gravitational wave antennas that came online 3 years ago in 2015 and finally had the sensitivity to see way out into the universe, by that time, actually, the theorists who work in general relativity had predicted that one ought to be able to see gravitational waves from sufficiently massive black hole stars or stellar black holes, which in pairs would combine and merge and produce a certain signal. But we didn't know whether those pairs of black holes ever existed. And so it was really very satisfying that for once the theoretical models that had been worked out for that gave exactly the right predictions for what was observed. And once one saw that, one could immediately interpret the data in great depth and great detail because the models had been so carefully prepared. Now, this means in a way that the community, the theoretical community, had caught up to the technology. But it took a long time for that to happen, and I think in this case it happened because the physicists were so eager to check out general relativity that they had built really complex models by then, and one could trust them.
What are the mysteries left in the universe that you would most like to see solved? What are the kind of unsolved questions that you personally would love to know the answers to?
Probably the ones that are the most interesting at the moment that one would like to know more about are the kinds of signals that would have been emitted in the first minute fraction of a second in the existence of the universe. And by minute, one means something like billions and billions and billions, as Carl Sagan used to say, 10 to the minus 43 seconds. So this would be a decimal point followed by 43 zeros and then a one for a fraction of a second. And that's some of that one is beginning to approach. And the microwave background radiation measurements that one has at the moment from the Planck mission and most recently that ESA had launched, the European Space Agency. But one would like to really understand what was going on in those eras and get more information.
I would also be interested to know what you think are the biggest hurdles to actually making some of those discoveries.
Probably it's the magnitude of the funding that would be required to get a complete view of what was going on. At the funding levels that we now have, which are really pretty generous when you think that astronomy is not really terribly useful to people's everyday lives, and so you have to reconcile yourself to the idea that, you know, people would rather feed their children than to have another astronomical discovery. But at the present funding levels, I think within a couple of centuries or so, we would probably have seen as much of what the universe is willing, as I said, to let us see without erasing it before it gets to us. And we'll know as much as we can at that point, probably.
Well, Martin, thank you very much for speaking to me today. It's been absolutely fascinating hearing your thoughts on cosmic discovery, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
That was Martin Harwit. You can find out more about how the most important astronomical bodies were first discovered in his book, Cosmic Discovery: The Search, Scope and Heritage of Astronomy. There's lots to see in the night sky this month, which we cover in detail in our sky guide in this month's issue. But if you're only going to see one thing in the night sky in February, take a moment to appreciate the full moon as it rises over the horizon on the 19th of February. It's going to be the largest one of the year, the perigee moon, which some people call the supermoon. From the centre of the UK, moonrise is at 5:15 p.m, and it'll be slightly earlier or later depending on your location. Many people claim that the moon appears to be at its largest when it's near the horizon, but this is an illusion. The perceived size difference is actually our brain playing tricks on us. The horizon gives our eyes a frame of reference, and our brain interprets this as the moon being larger. You can put the theory to the test by measuring the size of the moon with your fingers when it's near the horizon, and then again when it's high in the sky, and you should find the moon is the same in size no matter its elevation. So to find out more about why February's full moon really is bigger and not just an illusion, and if you fancy having a go at capturing the event on camera, it's all covered in the February issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine. So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about the latest missions to explore our solar system and black holes in the February issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine. And not forgetting our regular sections, which help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.